Saving Civilization One Tomato at a Time by Bonnie Buckaroo. Chapter 2, Changing the Paradigm.
Why food? I chose food as the topic for this book because if you do not have enough to eat, nothing else much matters. And because of my life, I feel it is my job to offer friendly advice to contemporary women on what we can do to make sure the next generation literally knows where its next meal will come from. Not long ago, I spent a summer working on a somewhat similar book called Surviving Tough Times. I completed 3 heavily footnoted chapters on food, on water, and on personal safety. I did a massive amount of research on the escalating problems facing us: climate change, economic instability, overpopulation, extreme weather, new diseases, drought. I even built a typology of disasters to assist in analyzing various scenarios and solutions. The end result was a rational and logical look at how we should prepare to deal with the coming chaos from climate change and other extinction-level events. But instead of feeling proud and inspired, my reaction was, meh. Why would people care? I wanted the book to be a call to action, something that would encourage people to make the changes we have ignored for too long. But there were already excellent books out there. Bill McKibben's Earth, Elizabeth Colbert's Sixth Extinction, Naomi Klein's This Changes Everything. Yet these excellent books have failed to ignite the groundswell of public participation it will take to turn things around. That's when I decided I wanted to talk primarily to women because I am one. I wanted to use my personal story to frame ideas about building an alternative future. Statistics alone have never persuaded anyone who is not already a believer. There are at least 100 scholars who could write a book as good or better than the one I had started. But only I can write this book because it is built out of my experiences. And because I am a woman, it argues that women are likely the best candidates to model the changes needed to build a sustainable civilization that you and I would want to live in. Indeed, I would argue that it is the prevailing macho, competitive, fear-based corporate model that has brought us to the edge of the cliff. My biggest fear is that our willingness to use violence to protect what we have and to fight for more will hurl us off the precipice. Past as predicate. The array of threats we face is unprecedented. Some, such as an electromagnetic pulse or a stock market plunge, have happened before. Yes, we could be struck by an asteroid and face a mass extinction, but the biggest threat humans have ever faced is climate change, and it is man-made. I am writing this during a week when an unexpected storm dumped 5 inches of rain on Detroit before depositing 13.57 inches on Islip, New York. And this was not associated with a hurricane. At the same time that thousands of people in Detroit were threatened with having their water turned off because they couldn't afford to pay their bills, residents of the city found themselves facing a deluge of biblical proportions. Weather events like these are now inevitable, and they will grow worse even if we dramatically cut our emissions of greenhouse gases today. And we clearly appear to be doing too little too late. To see where this leads, we have only to look at Jared Diamond's book, Collapse. In it, he talked about the disappearance of the Anasazi civilization that once flourished in the Four Corners area of Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah until the 12th century. As Diamond noted, the tribe was able to build 6-story skyscrapers that were not replicated again until the 1800s. Yet despite being clever enough to build a magnificent culture, they were not able to save themselves from environmental devastation. The author talks about how researchers were able to reconstruct much of the history of their demise by studying the archaeological record of the middens left behind by both the Anasazi and the pack rats that lived with them in Chaco Canyon. Middens are the refuse that humans and animals leave behind. The Anasazi ultimately disappeared because of short-sightedness. They relied on farming techniques that depleted the soil, and they cut down the forests without replanting. When the immediate environment could no longer sustain them, they picked up and moved, until a persistent drought left them nowhere to run to. They built their society on top of an environment that ultimately proved unforgiving. But their fatal flaw was failing to plan for problems that were clearly looming on the horizon. Sound familiar? It is impossible to look at the devastating drought in California today without wondering whether we are merely the latest civilization foolishly trying to wring everything we can from the natural world at our peril. The tensions between municipalities and farmers vying for the rights to water in California are escalating, and food prices are poised to rise either way. Local governments are rushing to issue new edicts on water use. Yet in July 2014, the UCLA campus was flooded with 20 million gallons of water when an ancient water main broke without warning. Like the Anasazi, we are failing to take actions that could protect us in the long run. We lack the vision and the will to make long-term investments in reservoirs and to repair our aging infrastructure. We ignore the reality that there is an inherent fragility in complex systems. We also couple our short-sightedness with a political system that rewards ignoring long-term threats. Politicians run for office every few years, which encourages them to ignore problems until they become a crisis. They also win elections by promising not to raise taxes, while assuring everyone that we can always do more with less. Like the Anasazi, we risk reaching a point where there are no more short-term fixes left. If we do not invest in a sustainable future when we have the time and money to do so, our chances of survival when we run out of both looks grim. My hope is that we have finally reached a time and place where we are willing to consider building a simpler, nurturing, community-based model built on collaboration and consensus. In the spirit of that generous and supportive woman who visited my little sandbox victory garden years ago. One little tomato will not be enough on its own to save a family in crisis, but it is an important first step toward self-sufficiency. Why women only? About writing for women only, I know full well the danger of generalizing and attributing certain characteristics, specifically the good ones, only to females, particularly now that we are learning that gender is more complex and diffuse than we acknowledged in the past. I also agree that gendered identity has more to do with culture than biology, and that there are more differences within a sex than between them. The last thing I want to do is contribute to stereotyping, because women are often diminished and marginalized by being placed into boxes and labeled. The glass ceiling persists because of the perception that women always this or women always that. That said, I would argue that women can bring something special to the table, especially the kitchen table, when we are allowed to contribute on our own terms. I know many women with the vision, experience, and skills to make a real difference, but not by emulating the way men operate. And while I'm not trying to pick a fight with men, I would argue that the traits associated with being male in our culture are a large part of why we find ourselves on the brink of extinction. Of course we want men as allies and benefit from their support. But we do not need their permission and approval. It's our turn to do it our way. Could we possibly do worse? Women and food. This book focuses on food because what we eat is so much a part of who we are. It is also what we do. Despite all the progress toward gender equality, women continue to be responsible for most of the food preparation in American homes. In a 2013 study in Nutrition Journal, researchers found that women still produce twice as many meals for their households as men do, though men have doubled their hours in the kitchen since the 1960s. This book is not designed to reinforce the stereotype of women as harried homemakers, stuck in a hot kitchen with a frozen smile. For many of us, growing, preserving, cooking, and serving food is a creative joy. Many women enjoy a special connection to the natural world. She's called Mother Nature for a reason. Accepting the responsibility for feeding ourselves and our families isn't a burden, but an integral part of our identity. However, as the inevitable disasters increase in both frequency and intensity, it will be women who will most often have to figure out how to cope with scarcity and rising prices. Many of us already know how to stretch a food nickel to provide a dollar's worth of nourishment. But the enormity of the threats looming ahead are daunting. Our challenge is to invent a new paradigm, one based on our strengths. One way women succeed is by coming in under radar, by which I mean we make change simply by doing what needs to be done and by persevering. The male model of open and unrelenting confrontation and competition invites resistance and continued conflict. The female model of problem solving relies on doing what works while minimizing conflict. Men seem to love the fight as much or more than the victory. They will battle to the death to eke out a 51-49% win, even though that typically leaves the other side bruised, battered, and bitter. Women, perhaps because we have historically had fewer opportunities to gain and use power, tend to focus more on solving the problem no matter who gets the credit. Women instinctively know that if a conflict devolves into a physical brawl where strength is the primary determinant, we lose. So it is better to employ all of our creativity on solving the underlying problem. And because we tend to be better attuned to the emotional dynamics, we recognize that if the losers have no stake in your success, the fight never really ends. Indeed, the blowback often means the problems grow worse. When women wield power. Looking at the two most powerful people in the United States today, President Barack Obama and First Lady Michelle, you see how differently they wield power on food issues and how that division tends to break along gender lines. A bit of history first. In the modern era, the Democratic Party has been the one to promote anti-hunger initiatives, attracting Republican support by tying these programs to various efforts to prop up farm prices. During the Great Depression, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt established Relief. That was a welfare program that provided excess farm commodities to people who were poor or unemployed. Both my mother and my father grew up on Relief, with its famous handouts of government cheese made from milk that would otherwise have depressed dairy prices. Yet Relief still left many folks hungry. President John F. Kennedy and his wife Jackie were famously stunned by the poverty and hunger they saw in Appalachia when he was first campaigning for the presidency. He called the war on hunger, quote, mankind's war of liberation, unquote. Kennedy also said, never before has man had such capacity to control his own environment, to end thirst and hunger, to conquer poverty and disease, to banish literacy and massive human misery. We have the power to make this the best generation of mankind in the history of the world, or to make it the last. Those words remind us what a different time the 1960s were, but how those words still echo today. Kennedy became president in 1961, and the first executive order he signed created the food stamp program. After JFK's death, President Lyndon Johnson broadened the program, making it arguably the most successful anti-poverty effort ever in the United States. Food stamps all but ended hunger. But then we began backsliding. Barack Obama won the presidency by offering people hope, including a pledge to end childhood hunger by 2015. He remains the only sitting president ever to give a major speech on ending world hunger. A former community organizer in low-income neighborhoods in Chicago, Obama worked directly with poor families trapped in neighborhoods where the only places that sell food are convenience stores that rarely offer anything more nourishing than soda and chips. The anti-hunger program Obama inherited had morphed into SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. In 1993, the federal government launched the EBT, Electronic Benefits Transfer System, that eventually allowed people to use their bridge cards to buy food with federal dollars. Yet the Great Recession of 2008 had left 1 in 4 American children food insecure, and 20 million more people had qualified for food assistance by 2011. It would seem one area where bipartisanship would reign would be feeding kids. However, in the male-dominated world of hardball power politics, when the Republicans gained control of the House of Representatives in 2011, food assistance came under siege as an example of big government that favors the takers, not the makers. GOP Senate candidate Dr. Greg Bannon channeled the resentment of the Tea Partiers. He supported their view that food stamps are not a way to feed hungry kids as much as a way that government is, quote, keeping itself in power by giving these goodies away. In our rancorous winner-take-all system, even wildly popular programs risk becoming collateral damage in the all-out war between the two parties. Food assistance came under assault because the only way to avert disaster during the budget battles was for both sides to agree to a sequester. The sequester was designed to impose deep automatic budget cuts if Congress did not agree on a budget. The theory was that the obstructionist Republicans would finally come to the table to avoid deep cuts in the military. The goad for Democrats to bargain in good faith would be to avoid huge cuts in the social safety net, including SNAP. But the architects of this strategy failed to appreciate the lengths politicians will go to avoid casting controversial votes. The threat of the sequester did not break the congressional logjam, and the automatic cuts for 2014 reduced SNAP benefits for 47 million people by $5 billion. Instead of fulfilling his campaign promise to end childhood hunger by 2015, the president may well end his presidency with more kids going to bed hungry than before. In the brutal world of power politics, the cuts in food assistance were merely collateral damage in a much larger ideological war, with the kids caught in the crossfire. Now let's contrast how First Lady Michelle Obama uses her soft power. Her main focus is on improving childhood nutrition by expanding access to healthy, fresh, local food in local schools. She supports programs that help kids avoid the health problems and self-esteem issues associated with childhood obesity by encouraging and expanding opportunities for physical activity. Her strategy relies in large part on leading by example. Many women connected emotionally to the images of Michelle Obama and a diverse group of kids digging in the dirt of the organic garden newly installed in the White House grounds. She appears on talk shows and visits schools where she talks about healthy food and encourages kids to exercise through her Let's Move initiative. She relies on a collaboration and consensus model to work with like-minded nonprofit groups to implement her agenda by helping them with theirs. By avoiding direct confrontation as much as possible, she has been able to use the persuasive power of her bully pulpit to make real progress, and the needle has started to move her way on nutrition and childhood obesity. But she also refuses to duck a fight. GOP legislators have been trying to slow the implementation of the new nutritional guidelines on school lunches passed in 2010 in the hope of killing the program altogether. Buoyed with contributions from Big Pharma and Big Food, Republicans argue that the program costs too much and that the kids prefer pizza and French fries to fruits and veggies anyhow. An article in Politico noted that the First Lady rarely wades into legislative battles, but this is one she cannot avoid. At a public roundtable on the issue, she used the power of her unofficial office to say, "The last thing we can afford to do right now is play politics with our kids' health." Women are relentless. If we find a rock that is too heavy to move blocking our way, we look for a path around it. Men often seem to prefer beating their heads against the rock again and again, but we think that just gives you a headache. Women will instead find a way to become the water that washes the rock away, or the water that seeps into the crevices until a freeze shatters it. While I'm not overly optimistic that we will avoid climate tragedy at a level we do not want to think about, I also believe that if we succeed in avoiding civilizational collapse, it will be because women played a significant role. Threaten the next generation, our collective cubs, and women will do whatever it takes. I also sense a critical mass building. At first, I thought it was just women my age. I would post a meme about GMOs on Facebook and find a number of new friend requests from older women who want to help make a difference. Now I'm finding the same response among young women as well. Why listen to me? Perhaps it's sheer hubris for me to think that I can make a valuable contribution in helping women prepare for what's on the horizon. But I think my age and my experience help qualify me to articulate what women should do to either prevent or cope with the growing problems surrounding food. Yes, I am old. In a culture that often devalues and dismisses women, particularly older women, as irrelevant or out of touch, turning 70 made me feel a certain urgency. I want to spend my remaining time sharing the lessons my decades of life have taught me. I have skills and advice to share about how we grow, preserve, distribute, and prepare food. I also spent 15 years of my life working full-time reporting on agriculture and food policy. Through a fluke, I was given a job writing about farming, though I knew next to nothing about it. that gave me a front row seat where I witnessed the policy decisions that changed family farming into corporatized agriculture. During those years, I became persuaded that we were headed down a dangerous path. In addition to being unsustainable, farming itself was beginning to pose a threat to the environment that endangers all living things on the planet. Admittedly, I enjoyed the dozen years I spent visiting farm families for Michigan Farmer, eventually as managing editor, and then as a freelancer for publications such as Farm Journal. As you will learn in subsequent chapters, it was heartwarming to see how hard people worked to bring fresh food to our tables. But that also meant witnessing firsthand the rise of industrialized farming, with its ever bigger tractors and toxic herbicides, pesticides, and chemical fertilizers. That job also meant chronicling the emergence of animal prisons called CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. I feel uniquely qualified to write this book because I have spent much of my life studying how these changes not only have implications for the food we eat, but the environment that sustains us. As a result, I made climate change the top issue in my campaign for Congress in 2000 as the Green Party candidate for Michigan's 8th District. Since I was in no danger of winning, I campaigned mostly at area high schools, where I tried to educate students about the world they would soon inherit. A few years later, the Climate Project, now called the Climate Reality Project, chose me as one of the first 1,000 people to be trained personally by former Vice President Al Gore. We were selected to become his representatives to carry the message of his Inconvenient Truth presentation to communities nationwide. For many years, I have used that experience to inform a freshman seminar on climate change and sustainability that I teach at Michigan State University. So I care. The book I was going to write was going to offer rational arguments and lots of statistics, but it lacked heart. Another thing I know about women is that most of us understand that solving problems requires using both our heads and our hearts. Feeling passionately about issues for women is not a bug, it's a feature. It's who women are. I know the odds are against us, but if we women band together and address the challenges overtly and covertly, we may be able to start saving our civilization one tomato at a time.